dear podcast friends, welcome to Insights and Beyond, Digitalization, Sustainability and Technology, the podcast by Trelleborg Sealing Solutions. You're in the right place if you're interested in the driving questions around topics like digitalization, electrification and sustainability. And above all, if you want to participate in a discussion with your exciting questions and comments. Experience the talks with our experts from Trelleborg and specialists from business, industry and research. So have fun with a new episode of Insights and Beyond. How good are we actually at digitalization? There's often kind of a perceived truth to this. Some pessimists rate us worse than we are. Others look to our development with a naivety somehow. The facts are that USA dominates the field of major patents in the sector of digitalization with a percentage about 50%. Asia accounts for 30% and Europe for just 10%. Does this fact make Germany a digital developing country? That's what I'm talking about today with Niklas Kühl, Head of Applied AI Lab at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology, and Johannes Kunze von Bischofshausen, Manager Digital Transformation at Trelleborg Sealing Solutions. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
So, first question and first task for you. If someone were to give a book title about your impact on digitalization, what would be the title of the book?
Yeah, so I mean, my title would be probably Artificial Intelligence in Systems or in Service Systems, because what I find most fascinating about the whole topic of digitalization and the introduction of artificial intelligence is the idea that you can generate a lot of value if you learn not only in isolated cases within single businesses, but do this holistically in whole supply chain systems, for example, or in a cooperating model between different companies that generate value together. So I think that's, for me, one of the most interesting aspects is how can we leverage these effects that you have if you bring together data or machine learning models from different companies, from different institutions, and then see what you can do and how all of these participants in such a system then would benefit from that again.
That sounds that like that's not just an idea. It sounds like you're already writing the book.
Almost, yeah. No, I mean, in general, this is what I'm researching on within the lab. So, of course, this is my day-to-day business. But I still believe in this idea to be very valuable. Yeah.
But can we read a book like that soon?
Well, you can. I mean, there's one book coming out actually in December, which is called Smart Service Management, which has a focus on the service aspect of the whole idea. But of course, I'm also working on additional publications in this area.
So, Johannes, what is it about you? Is there still a white paper in front of you, or are you already writing a book as well?
Well, since the first title we discussed already in our previous podcast, there is a second part of it, and that's scaling up the digital transformation from pilots to mass applications. So that means the question is, how do we bring our isolated pilots into reality? How do we use them in a day-to-day practice?
Is that a book you're actually working on, or is it just an idea?
We are working on that in Trelleborg Sealing Solutions in implementing our pilots into the real world, into the factories, into our day-to-day sales business. But the book to be written, that's still a part, that's still a task. The book still has to be written.
So it's the upcoming season is the cold season, so I think you have enough time to write it right now. The winter is a good time for it.
Definitely.
But it's very good to see and to hear that there are some helpful things for the people that enable them to do the digital transformation, because we're talking a lot about, we're talking a lot of these big pictures, but the enabling of the people is one of the most important things, in my opinion, to really, to get the things done. And another thing what I'm interested in is we're talking a lot about digitalization. Niklas, what question would you like to be asked because you think it addresses a very important fact or a very important field, but at the same time, it's a very unnoticed problem?
Yeah, I think when you look into the whole area of outsourcing core competencies, this is a field that is discussed very negatively, while on the other hand, we can quite get a lot of benefits if you look at companies which specialize in one very precise thing and do this thing very well and have scaling effects by doing so and learn more about all the different participants using that very service or idea. So what I am missing a little bit is discussions about all the positive effects of, and I don't really like the term, but of outsourcing certain parts of your business to someone who might be actually doing a better job in that and then concentrating on something else that you might do better.
Mm-hmm. What is it for you?
It's definitely how do we want to do change management in the age of AI? So as we discussed, we see a lot of pilots, and that's what we also see in Trelleborg Ceiling Solutions, but that's a general challenge in all companies is there might be a lot of different, very interesting pilots in the AI space, but then the question is, and you might get some valuable insights already, but then the question is, how do you scale this up? How do you make people, salespeople, how do you make the shop floor in manufacturing use these models? How do you make sure that people actually adopt it and that it will not just be a nice research project inside the organization?
Yeah, something you can write on your website. We use AI, but maybe. We had the pleasure to join the virtual conference of Trelleborg Ceiling Solutions in July, and therefore we ask our audience to ask their question that we can discuss the topics. And there are still so many questions left, and I think we have to, we also had to look for some questions we can answer today. So we start with our first question. The first question is, European data protection regulations have been criticized for slowing down developments in the field of digitalization and AI. Do you think these criticisms are justified?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we have to look at GDPR from a different perspective, because at least for Germany, these similar laws were already in place since even before 2018. Just the way of how companies need to document their processes and how the consequences are enforced are different since May of 2018. But I personally think that there is a way in between for still accounting for privacy and the GDPR regulations, while on the other hand, still providing beneficial and high-performing artificial intelligence solutions. I'd like to give a very simple example from one of the projects that I'm currently working on. And it shows, in my perspective, how technology can overcome certain issues that you think might occur when working with private data. So, as you all know, in the current corona pandemic, there are a lot of different non-pharmaceutical interventions called NPIs. So these are measures so that the virus doesn't spread as fast. And one of these NPIs that was introduced across a lot of countries all over the world is the NPI of mask wearing. So people wearing masks in public, wearing masks in restaurants and so on. But if you look at how you could monitor this mask wearing, you can't place people in front of every store and every restaurant and every public place. So you need some kind of technology to help you with that. So what we developed is a type of surveillance system that helps you to identify and monitor what the percentage of people wearing masks is in a current situation. And now there are two ways to approach it. The one is you simply work on the data showing all the faces, which might reveal personal information, right? So I could know that Sarah or Johannes were in a certain store at a certain time. And then you would get a very high artificial intelligence performance. The recognition grade would be very, very high also on the one hand of the mask, but on the other hand also on the personal data. Now, our approach was a little bit different because what we thought we need a step before that, which will blur the images so that you cannot recognize a single person anymore. But on the other hand, you're still able to recognize whether or not they were wearing a mask. And by doing that, technology helps us to overcome issues in the privacy field. And what's interesting is the trade-off here between privacy preservation on the one hand and the AI performance on the other hand. But what we found out, which is, I think, pretty interesting, is that we can still allow for a high AI performance, although we keep the information private and secured. So our, speaking in technical terms, our accuracy goes down a little bit of the detection of masks, but we still preserve the privacy of the people on the images. And in the end, we still get very good results. And so I think it's an interesting field to work in and to see how technology can help to assure both high performing performance on the one hand and on the other hand still preserving privacy. So this is definitely something that you can approach.
Targeting the debate in the media, I really have to ask, did all these Sarahs and Johannes really wear their masks?
So, I mean, what we did is obviously we did a very small study and we first had to generate data for our AI. So we took some public data sets that are out there. We went into the city of Karlsruhe where I'm working, took some pictures of people wearing masks. And then we used this to train the AI, and the AI scored very well on unidentified pictures. But we didn't do an analysis on a public space in any city. So I can't really tell you how the percentage of mask wearing is right now, because it still needs to be implemented, obviously, into a real world setting. This is just, you know, some early work in the field.
So I call you in a few months and then I ask you
Absolutely,
again.
Absolutely, please do.
Yeah, but as you really mentioned right now, you're working in a scientist, in a science field. So this is quite another approach, because if you have to work in the business sector, you have competitors all over the world, like Trelleborg Sealing Solution. You're also a global company. Is it really like I don't know, the guy asked, is it slowing down our development in terms of digitalization when we are regulated by all these data protections?
So from my perspective, GDPR does not block any digital OAI innovation in Trelleborg Sealing Solutions, and for two reasons. The first one is, I think that that following GDPR rules can still be a competitive advantage. And we in Trelleborg Sealing Solutions decided to implement the GDPR guidelines globally. That means that in the end, even if we get some stricter rules in other continents like Americas or Asia, we can be quite relaxed about it. The second part is, how often does GDPR actually apply to our AI use cases? And to be honest, the answer is most of the times it does not affect anything. So we deal a lot with industrial data, for example. We deal a lot with internal data without any relationship to a specific person. So, for example, talking about image recognition and where we use it. We use it, for example, for detecting seal defects and automating visual inspection. And that is data which does not have any privacy issues at all, because it's photos of our products during the manufacturing process.
Mm. One big part of all these AI things is the data. That's the base of everything, data. And we need a lot of data to develop some AI applications. And that reminds me of my study time. I always went everywhere and I collected every book I could get. And I had the feeling, all right, these books are there. I have the information. Unfortunately, I had no time to look in those books, but I had a good feeling that all the information was there. And I think it's the same thing with data. Every company is collecting data and data and data, but it's not useful for them, because sometimes we need a more, we need a better data quality to use it. So here's another question from the audience. The basic requirements for AI applications or machine learning is a corresponding data quality. What strategies are used to make existing data usable?
So the answer is quite simple. Good processes make good data. And therefore, we also do what you just described with your books from the library, because we are required from legal perspective. So, for example, in the healthcare and medical industry, there is a lot required regarding traceability, and therefore we store also a lot of data which might never be used, but for some cases we might use it, need to look at it again. That is one part of it. But then, and I would say that's the majority of our digitization project, we really have a plan behind what kind of data do we want to collect and how do we want to use it, for example, for continuous improvement in manufacturing. And to give you one example, we implemented a solution to monitor machine activities and trace how well our assets are used. And this requires also some manual input from our operators, like downtime coding, the reasons why a machine is not running, was there no material, was a machine breakdown. And of course, on the shop floor, it's not always easy to maintain data quality on a high standard, but that in our tool, we implemented, for example, a backlog. So that means that the shift leaders can see how well they are maintaining the data, that they can feed the backlog even afterwards. And in some extreme examples, we even created an alert on the shop floor when the downtime reason was not coded at all. So there you see, you need to strategically plan data collection. And what definitely does not work is just looking at a bunch of data which is just captured without any purpose and then trying to come up with some brilliant AI stuff. That's definitely not working.
So should the company start? I mean, there's really like my books, they're lying there. We have a lot of data, but how can they work and start working with them? How can they bring data quality in it?
It always starts with a use case. So the question is, of course, what am I trying to achieve? And then it's an iterative process. So the typical, and that does also not include our projects in Trelleborg Ceiling Solutions, the typical setup is we have a great idea of doing a specific forecast or coming up with predicting anything. And then we realize, okay, the data quality for this use case is not good enough. We can do something, but it's not perfect yet. And then we have to close the loop and start again and learn from it what kind of data do we need to capture. Same example is in the application space. So we work a lot with customers on analyzing their sensor data in the application. So for example, in hydraulics, and there's the same issue. So typically, they might have some sensors already in place, but it's not enough. And we look at the existing sensor data. We look at how can we correlate it, to seal performance and seal life. And then very often we see, okay, we can suggest you should put a sensor in this place or in this place. And then we will increase performance. So it's definitely not a one-off thing, all AI projects. It's always a continuous improvement over time.
Maybe it's a good advice to hire someone or work with someone who's a data curator. I learned that that this is a job, data curation, a data curator. Maybe that could be helpful for a company. I've got another question. I think, Niklas, that's a question for you because it affects your working field pretty much. The question is, some people suggest that developments in automation, such as RPA, will provide huge benefits for future production processes. How is this linked to AI?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, this is a definitorial question. So where does automation start? Where does it stop? Where does AI start? So in the end, I think there are aspects of artificial intelligence that can support you in your automation endeavors, but not every automation endeavor that you pursue needs by law or an artificial intelligence or machine learning component, right? So I think you have to look at it very use case specific and see what is the ultimate goal that this company tries to reach and which aspects of this of their existing processes can be automated and in which of these process steps can AI generate additional value or help to automate these processes. So it's not, for me, it's not either or. I mean, both are linked together. And I think it's really interesting because if you look into research all the debates that happened about automation in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they all appear now again, this time not with the label of automation, but with artificial intelligence. Topics like how much can you trust the system? Back then it was just about automation, but now it's about an AI giving recommendations or predictions. You know, is this trustworthy or not? Do we maybe go to something called an automation bias? So do we over rely on these solutions then? And it's really interesting because you don't need to look into the scientific literature from the past months or years. You can just really go 50 years back and it's all there already.
Mm. From a perspective of a business, it's very interesting to use RPA. I mean, the value of it is in best case, you're more efficient, you're faster. Does that make you more competitive in the same way?
So speaking about automation, we have to separate between automating IT systems and automating manufacturing processes. Speaking about IT systems and the big hype around RPA, that's my personal view, it's a hot fix on a broken system. So we see this a lot, for example, in the insurance industry or in the banking industry, that 30 years old systems are now automated and using tools that also rely on artificial intelligence. But that's just a hot fix. So our philosophy in Trelleborg Ceiling Solutions is go more on the root cause and keep our systems up to date. So just one example, we have a big ERP implementation project ongoing where we set SAP S/4HANA as a standard. So that's one part of it. That's the software automation. The automation in manufacturing, that's something which was there since the 70s already. Of course, the question is also always in automation: is it cost efficient, and what is it worth to automate? And there, I see a big dependency between AI and automation in general. Because first, automation creates a lot of data. If you use robots, if you use a more automated manufacturing equipment, it's typically staffed with a lot of sensors for control purposes, but that you can afterwards also use for other purposes, for maybe some AI use cases. And then on the other hand, AI also allows you to automate things that would not have been possible before. And again, this example of visual inspection, with advanced techniques in image recognition, you can today automate the visual inspection of parts, which was not possible before, because traditional methods are very dumb in a sense that you only a comparison of pixels by pixels. That means they would learn there should be a black pixel or there should be a white pixel, but they would not really be able to detect defects. And that's the big difference. So in the end, you can automate more by means of artificial intelligence.
So it's good to hear that you're also using it. I mean, there's a picture painted in a society that the Germans are way behind all these other countries, and I have the feeling it isn't so. So all those pessimists, they rate us really worse. And now we've come to a point I like most. It's really one of my favorite parts of the podcast because it's the solution or sci-fi part. I read out a line and I want you to estimate if that is kind of a solution for the future, if it's right, or it's more like a sci-fi idea I created. So here's your line: solution or sci-fi. The intelligent automation of the German industry will bring us back to the world elite.
Yeah, I mean, That's a good statement. The question is...
I know, it's mine.
Yeah, you did a good job on that. So the question is whether it's the goal of the German industry to be as innovative as possible right now or not, or if they are rather traditional in some aspects. So, yeah, I'm not too sure. I can't really decide whether this is going to definitely happen or this will... stay a statement in this podcast.
It's a good question. Do we really want to be as innovative as other countries? I didn't know that this is quite a question. So what do you say, Johannes?
I mean, in the end, it's not about being innovative. It's about creating value with digitization or with tools. And that is also our philosophy in general, that we really look at what makes sense, what creates value for internal purposes or for our customers, and then focus on the right things. So it's not about being as digital as possible in the end.
As digital as possible, maybe that is not our goal, but being innovative could be a goal. And I did some research and I found a ranking of the magazine Fast Company. That's a magazine published by former authors of the Harvard Business Review. And they always rank once a year the most innovative companies. And in my opinion, this is kind of the fastest on the market as well. So what's very, very interesting in this ranking is that almost exclusively, there are startups. So there are almost no companies, no corporates ranked in there. And unfortunately, we have no German company within the top 50. So how do we get our corporates, our German corporates, to speedboats?
Yeah, that may actually sound very depressing if you say it like that. But then again, of course, I mean, startups have the infrastructure and the nature that is much closer to the spirit of innovation. So this doesn't really surprise me. I think in the end, it depends really on the strategy of the business on how they deal with innovation. So is this something that they see as a distinct process within their R&D department? Is this something that is in the very DNA of every employee? For example, like the Google, they have their Fridays where they can that they can use for creative, innovative new ideas and work on their own products. Or is the spirit more that you observe the market very closely and then decide which startups or existing businesses you'd like to acquire and then integrate them into your company? And I think either of these three strategies has their ups and downs, but maybe it's a conscious choice that no German companies in there. Although I doubt that, to be honest, but you never know. Maybe it's all strategy.
I was surprised that Apple is on the 39th place. That's way, way behind, I thought. But speaking of DNS, Johannes, your DNS is intrapreneurship. At least that's what I read on your LinkedIn profile. So how do we get those corporates faster and in more innovative and more like a startup? Is that even possible?
It is possible to some extent. And there are a couple of things that companies can do. The first one is follow an open innovation approach. And that means innovation does not always happen in a closed shop where some genius comes up with a great idea and it's going to change the world. Open innovation means working with external parties. That could be a startup, for example, but it could also be a research institute like the KIT team, or it could be even a customer and develop things with an open mindset. That's number one. Number two, setting up dedicated resources with a different background. And that's something I personally strongly believe in. When you bring in people with a different background, and that's what we did for our digital transformation approach, people with a mechanical engineering background, with electrical engineering background, with an IT, with a data science background, then new ideas are born. And then lastly, we have a hybrid model. That means we have some dedicated resources to it, but then based on our approach that we have a decentralized model, especially in manufacturing sites, you see all the small innovations, even on the shop floor, in engineering new products, and that's I think the three main reasons why we were quite well with digital innovation and especially AI innovation so far, because we combined the three.
Well, maybe we should be a little bit louder with our innovations. I mean, the American people, they're telling us every time when they have a new application that's an innovation. So maybe we should be only a little bit braver in that case. Our last question before we come to our ceiling test is, and I think that's one for you as well, Niklas. I mean, you're not working at Google, but maybe you can estimate how the development goes. The question is, Google is no longer developing their VR AR glasses with AI for the consumer sector. Why is this? And are there other organizations developing something similar?
Yeah, I mean, it's in Google's nature to fail fast and early. So it's if you look into the history of Google, they've always came up with new products and new services that then got discontinued. So I myself was a fan of a lot of Google services that are not around anymore. So I think this is just something that happens all the time. If you're interested in Google products or services, doesn't mean that the company's not interested in that anymore. But to answer your question, there are definitely a lot of virtual reality, mixed reality, and augmented reality sets already available at the market. They do not have right now the strong B2B focus. They're more on for the B2C level. But right now you can buy, for example, an Oculus Quest, which is a wireless headset that you can just put it on your head and start playing around with that. Its application within an industrial area, I think that's not yet mature. I mean, there are a lot of examples out there, but they are all more or less research projects on how you can use this technology. I'm still waiting on the killer app for an industrial application. Although you can imagine a lot of these, but I've never seen anything in production yet. But yeah. So the headset, the hardware is out there. It's just a question of the precise service or solution.
So we're still waiting for the killer app.
Yes.
I keep that in mind. So at the end of our podcast, we always do our ceiling test. And for the ceiling solutions, we use a material which is called rubber. And that sounds not that exciting, but rubber has got two exciting aspects. One aspect is the resilience. That's a capability of a material to return to its initial state after a huge pressure. And on the other hand, rubber is very, very flexible. So here's our ceiling test. And I start with you, Johannes. Where do we need to become more resilient to drive digitalization forward? And of course, where do we have to become more flexible to drive digitalization forward?
So we need to be more resilient on scaling up the use case. And that fits nicely to what we talked in the beginning. Very often we see a lot of pilots or proof of concepts happening. And then you might have some first initial insights, for example, from an AI project, but then it stops and it's not scaled up and it's not continued. And that is something what we definitely have to work on. We talked about closing the loop and improving over time. So maybe in the first project you learned data quality is not good enough, but then you have to revisit it after 2 years. Hopefully you worked on the data quality and then you can start again. So definitely more resilience on the real implementation side instead of sticking to the research part of it. And then when it comes to more flexibility, I'm strongly convinced that we need more flexibility in how AI intelligence and human intelligence works together in the future. And we see some very silly examples in our day-to-day life already. So I would say that navigation systems are quite advanced today, and they have very sophisticated algorithms in guiding vehicles. They rely on real-time data on a huge database, but still a lot of humans think that they are smarter than those systems and would just simply ignore it and keep on driving the same way. And I think that is something that we will see in 10 and 20 years in businesses as well, that even if there are proven AI algorithms that have quite a good database, they might still be ignored because humans are not used to work with them.
I think you can replace human and put in male and man person in there. I've got a great statistic to that. 90% of the male drivers in Germany think that they drive a lot better than the average driver. So I'm not good at math, but that couldn't be. So, Niklas, what about you?
Yeah, so I think there's never been a better time to talk about resilience in organizations in general or IT systems in specific. Because right now you can observe which businesses were more or were less resilient in the corona pandemic. And I think resilience has two interesting aspects, and we almost always ignore one of them. So let's start with a positive one. So what happens if your business suddenly scales up? People go more into the supermarket. People use more telecommunication software like Skype, WebEx, Zoom, and so on. Now, is your organization prepared to scale up from one point to the other in a short time? And this is also resilience. You know, how resilient are you towards a positive change in the market? And how well can you account for that? And we've seen examples where this went well in the pandemic and some others where it didn't go that well. So where servers were not accumulated to the amount of requests that they were handling. And then, of course, there's I'd call it the negative side of resilience is like if your business, you know, goes down, if you have less demand, for example, in the airline industry. The thing is there are enough measures to prepare for each way. But it's very unpopular to talk about resilience in times where there is no crisis happening. So to answer your question, we should talk about resilience not only now, but I would like, hopefully in 1 or 2 years, all of this has calmed off, but to talk about it then again, to talk about resilience in a time where it's not needed, but the preparation for this resilience needs to be performed.
And this goes hand in hand with flexibility, I think.
Yeah, I mean, talking about flexibility, I really liked Johannes' example of, let's say, a navigation system or a Google Maps. It's interesting how flexible people are with their decisions and how much they let their decisions be guided by an AI, for example. But I think it's also not only the users, it's never them, it's also the developers. So if we can observe that people do not trust or do not follow the decisions that were made by a system, I think then it's up to us, the developers, and I'm including myself here, how can we build solutions that people start to trust more or that they start to be more compliant with? And I mean, there are a lot of options on how to do that, right? So the AI can start explaining itself better in the example that Johannes mentioned, right? So I see that there's a traffic jam on this road, so I would advise you against using that. And then if the system is able to explain itself better, to be more transparent about its inner workings, then hopefully this makes people more flexible in their decisions on whether or not to comply with a decision of an AI.
I have to say, I really trust and follow your estimations here. So thanks a lot for your time and all your insights. I'm looking forward to the killer app and also to your book releases. And of course, I'm looking forward to talking to you soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you don't want to miss anything, just subscribe to our podcast. And of course, we are happy to receive feedback from you. So we're looking forward to your ratings and comments. And of course, we still want to answer your questions. Therefore, feel free to write us at info.podcasts@trelleborg.com. Thanks a lot and see you next time.